All right, we've left off in Revelation chapter 19. If we don't finish this chapter today, we should get very close. Then, Lord willing, 2 weeks from today, we'll be out next week because of visiting the folks in Illinois. We will, at that time, intend on finishing out Revelation 19, introduce Revelation 20. We will spend some time on introducing the 20th chapter because there's a lot there, and people draw sometimes some really wild conclusions from it. And then we'll get into Revelation 20. And then 21 and 22, and then the book will be done. Now, we've said several times that the approach to the class is that in the book of Revelation, John goes through cycles. He will talk about things related to the Christian era, and then he'll go through until the end of time, talk about a couple things at the end of time, and then he just goes back and he continues to repeat this cycle throughout the book. Now, in Revelation 19, we are in the midst of one of these cycles. He's talking about some of the things that happened throughout the Christian era. And if you go back and look a little bit, we missed last Sunday because of the snow situation, but he says back there in verse 9, he was told, "Right, blessed are they that have bidden to the marriage supper of the Lamb. They're the true words of God." John, we talked about verse 10, how he tried to fall down and worship a creature. Here it's not specifically said that it's an angel. A little later in the book, we do find that he once again tried to do this. In that later instance, it was an angel. And this creature says, "I'm a fellow servant. Don't worship me. Worship God." Verse 11, and you can really, I think, see here the imagery for the Christian era. John sees heaven open. He's got this white horse before him. There's a rider, faithful and true. Who is that? All right, it's Jesus. Not literally that he's riding a horse, but it's an image to say that throughout the Christian era, Jesus is going forth. He's conquering. He's judging. He's making war. That, of course, would be a reference to things like sin. The eyes are like a flame of fire upon his head, many crowns to show his power, his authority. And then we talked about the name that no one knows. He's arrayed in a garment, sprinkled with blood. And then, of course, his name is the Word of God. This then brings us to verse 14. "And the armies which are in heaven followed him upon white horses, clothed in fine linen, white and pure." Now, we've talked about white in the book of Revelation at previous times. My thinking is, based on what we've said thus far, is that maybe there's going to be some color, if you will, of clothing, in heaven for God's people. But right now, here, the emphasis is on, in this life, God's people wear white. Well, we know that to be true, right? If we walk in the light as he's in the light, what happens? The blood of Christ continues to cleanse us, ongoing action. So Romans 5:2, we're able to stand in the grace of God. So as the Christian era continues, those who become God's people, they're walking in the light, they're living according to God's will, they wear, figuratively speaking, or spiritually speaking, they wear white. It's interesting, perhaps, to note that under the Old Testament, you may remember the priests. Did the Old Testament priests wear the same clothing as everybody else, or did they have some special clothing? All right, they did have some special clothing. You can go back, passages like Exodus chapter 28 give a lot of information about that. Well, as we look forward now to the New Testament era, the era that we're under, are there any priests?
We're all priests?
All right, 1 Peter 2, verses 5 and 9, God says all of his people, all of his saints are saints. So you can kind of think, see there a connection, I think, as well to the Old Testament. Priests, special clothing. Now, here we are, under the New Testament, priests as well, and we are, if you will, clothed in white. So you have here in verse 14 the idea of God's people being led by Jesus in this spiritual battle, and our battle garb, our battle uniform is, if you will, righteousness. We've also touched on this a couple of times. In contrast to God's people who were pictured as wearing white, what's the picture, what's the image for the unrighteous throughout the Christian era? What's their spiritual clothing like?
Black.
Well, okay, it would be black, dingy, soiled, ugly, stained, those kinds of things. And then John even goes one step further. Do you remember back in Revelation 16, verse 15? He says, they're walking around naked. Remember that? So the image there, Galatians 3:27, "For as many of you as have been baptized into Christ, you've done what? You've put on Christ." Well, think of that in terms of clothing. You've clothed yourself with Christ. You've got the right spiritual garment. And we talked a little bit before about, remember Jesus' teaching concerning the king? There's the wedding feast. And there's the guy, he doesn't have the right garment. He doesn't have the right clothing. So he's naked, if you will, for that event. He lacks the proper clothing, and he is cast out. So you have all those things taking place here. Then, then John talks about something else. He refers to, in verse 14 of Revelation 19, he talks about the righteousness, the good deeds of the saints. And what's he say about those good deeds? He says the fine linen, it represents the
righteousness.
Okay, it represents the righteousness of the saints. Well, as we go through life, we can have righteousness. Yes, at the end of verse 8, you find that same point expressed as well. So as we're involved in that way of life, we wear white, if you will. Excuse me, this is not a new idea. Passage that was used quite a bit by older preachers was back in the book of Isaiah chapter 1, verse 18, and we're probably at least a little familiar with it. God said, though your sin be as scarlet, it's red, it's a bad stain, it shall become what? White as snow. Well, there again, you have the same kind of idea. Not literally, but God uses that imagery to say that the sins are going to be cleansed, they're going to be taken from people. Now, if you read along with me Revelation 19:14, you might say, all that sounds pretty good, but I'm still not convinced. There's one thing that bugs me a little bit. And it says, and the armies, I'm not understanding that as angels, I'm understanding that as God's people throughout the Christian era. He says these armies are where? All right. Well, we're not there yet, are we?
Mine says which were in heaven. Is that what you're saying?
Are.
Mine says are.
Okay. Are, in, were. Let's see if we can join all these together. Remember, throughout the book of Revelation, we have information as early as Revelation 2 where the text talks about reigning with Christ. Well, a lot of people think that reigning is going to occur in eternity, and it certainly will. But don't we begin to reign in this life? Remember back there in the book of Ephesians, Paul talked about you become a Christian and what's happened, even Colossians 3, verses 1 and 2. You've been raised up with Christ, and he says now you're in the what places? Remember that word? Now you are with Christ in the heavenly places. Remember that? The illustration that we gave before, and this is still the best illustration I can offer, is that if you were to be appointed to the president's cabinet, President Obama, as far as our current president, would you not reign with him? Would you not rule with him? Well, you're part of his administration. Well, if we're clothed with Christ, Galatians 3:27, then are we not part of his administration? We are. So beginning in this life, we start to rule. We start to reign with Christ. A lot of people say, even when they think about Jesus and his reign, people can look at the world and they can say, it really looks like who's in charge? Jesus or somebody else? All right, it may look like somebody, when you see this happening and, sin seems to abound, it may not look like Jesus is on the white horse or he's not being very effective. But we're going to see, verse 16 in just a couple of minutes, the Lord is reigning. And as his people, even though it may seem like there are times where we're trampled and we're cast down and things are not going too well, the image here, the armies in heaven, it's a way of saying we're reigning with Christ now and then, of course, in the future. I think it's also... Yes, there are some people that would take that particular view. One of the things that would point me away from that is that when he talks about, the white, unless you want to understand that as angels running around in white robes or something like that, you have here a spiritual description for God's people, our status as well as our job. But you do have some people who understand these armies, if you will. And surely the armies of heaven include the angelic host, if you will. But here, I think I would add that we want to include men as well. But you're right, you will find that view if you look at some other works. Was there somebody else that started to raise a hand? Okay. A couple of the things that I do want to mention here. When we think about being in this spiritual army, as we look at the physical armies on the earth, do we sometimes have some problems with soldiers? Time for battle. Time to go get shot at and maybe shot up. What happens with some guys? Yeah, cowards. And they may not just be a coward, they may just not, run across the way and try to hide in a foxhole or something. What might they do? Even worse. All right. AWOL. They go AWOL, absent without leave, or sometimes they would use the word deserter to describe somebody that's fled. You think we can have that same thing in the church? We can have AWOL members. You're supposed to be here living the Christian life, but you've deserted. And... You know, this is one of the things that people hopefully get better with as they go through life. But do you think we sometimes have spiritual cowards in the church? It can happen, especially in the younger years as people are put into situations that are difficult. So that's something, as far as the problem of being a coward, we want to work on and get stronger. We certainly do not want to be AWOL, absent, without leave.
But I think, Brad, if you don't become strong when you're young, it gets even worse when you get
yes.
older.
Yeah, it does.
Because it's just been fostering that through the years.
Yeah, one of the quotes that we looked at Wednesday night as far as boastfulness essentially said that from, I don't remember who wrote those words, whether it was Washington or Shakespeare. I think it was one of those guys. But anyway, the point was you form habits. And if those are good habits, they stick with you through life. If you know, cowardly behavior is a habit that you form, because like I say, everybody will under certain circumstances. But if that becomes a way of life, it just becomes more and more ingrained as the years go by. So good habits, good patterns are what we need to abide by. Anybody else? Yeah. Well, the world has always been good at bullying God's people, at intimidating God's people, and we see some of that in the news on a regular basis today. And like I say, there are some times where we don't respond very well to that. Preachers can also fall in the same category. There have been some elders that have failed to do, you know, what they needed to do. You know, some Bible class teachers. So again, we're not going to be perfect people as we go through life. But our goal needs to be, we want to be as strong as we can for God, and we want to develop those good habits so as the years go by, we'll be even stronger. But it is a challenge that we face, and sometimes we fail. Anybody else? All right, let's move down a little bit to what we find now in verses 15 and 16 of Revelation 19. Still talking about this spiritual battle that's taking place throughout the Christian era, and Christ is the leader. And out of his mouth, that would be Jesus' mouth, out of his mouth proceeded a sharp sword, that with it he should smite the nations, and he shall rule them with a rod of iron. And he treadeth the winepress, and the fierceness of the wrath of God the Almighty. And he hath on his garment and on his thigh a name written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Now if you think back to what we just talked about in verse 14, we've got some military image here, right? You know, got Christ on the horse, and he's out there making war against sin, and his people are following him. They're also involved in this spiritual battle. And Paul talks about that, for example, in the book of Ephesians chapter 6. You know, put on the Christian armor. Well, how come? Not because it's pretty, because we're in a battle. You know, we're involved with a spiritual conflict. Well, this is another example of why I've said the information in Revelation is really, in many ways, a restatement of what we find elsewhere in the New Testament. Revelation, though, as we go through the book, it just makes these points in a different way, typically through figurative language, and you see that here. And in this case, we have Jesus. He is possessing a sharp sword. We saw the same kind of thing back in Revelation chapter 1, verse 16. It's coming out of his mouth to smite the nations. Well, not literally. I mean, he doesn't have a big sword coming out of his mouth. It's figurative information, and what's it designed to say? What's the image telling us? This sword coming out of his mouth. All right, his word. And the information there as far as smiting, striking the nations, how's he doing that? If the sword is his word, all right, by the judgment of his word and the teaching of that, if you will. You know, here's the information, and you're going to respond to it positively or negatively. Hopefully it's going to convict people. It's going to poke people, if you will, in the right way, and they are going to be obedient. But that doesn't always happen. You may recall back in Matthew 10:34, Jesus said, "Think not that I came to send what on the earth? Don't think that I came to send peace." But Jesus said, "I want you to know I came to send a sword." Well, as we look here at Revelation 19, verses 15 and 16, what do we find? He says, "There's a sword that's coming out of my mouth." Well, that's exactly what we have back there in Matthew 10. And if somebody starts waving around a sword, you think they're going to stir things up? Yeah, most people would say, "You've got my attention." Remember Acts 17:6, what's said about Christians? They, as they went and you know, began to preach and teach, "These have turned the world." Yeah, well, that's the same message that we have here, isn't it? He's going forth in this spiritual battle. He's smiting people and literally turning the world upside down. And John also, back in Revelation 2, verse 27, talked about this same activity, Revelation 12, verse 5. And we know that the gospel is God's power to save man, Romans 1, 16. It's also the power to judge people. One commentator made this point, which I like the thought. He said, cake and ice cream sermons are gone. When people hear the truth of God's word preached, it can make them very angry, or it can, you know, prick their hearts, as we see on the day of Pentecost, and turn them to the right way. Now, as you have that kind of source or power going forth into the world, do you think that people are going to react to it?
They do today.
We can just point to various examples. Well, as you keep that in mind, let's go back and look at some of the information that we've already covered. Verse 11, and I saw the heaven open, behold, a white horse, and he that sat thereon was faithful and true, and in righteousness he does judge and make war. War is going to be an attention-getting activity. You know that you're involved in a battle. And then verse 13, and he is arrayed in a garment which is sprinkled or dipped in blood. Well, not literally, but it is describing the greatness of this spiritual conflict. And then at the end of verse 15, he treads the winepress of the fierceness of the wrath of God. We'll talk about that just a little bit more here in a bit. So, very, very powerful image. Well, let's just do it now. Since it's kind of fresh on my mind and hopefully on yours, he is treading the grapes. Now, if you were to do that, if you had a big, and you wouldn't have to have grapes, but they're a good illustration. If you had this big vat of grapes, and it may not sound like the best way to do it for us, but these fellows would go in there with their feet, they're barefoot, you know, squish, 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 squish. Well, what's that going to do? What's going to happen as you go in there and you just start, you know, trampling up and down, maybe jumping up and down a little bit?
It's slippery in there.
All right, it's going to get slippery. Okay, I didn't quite get the... Okay, splashing. And as that's going to be the word that I want here. As that juice is splashed, what's going to happen to your clothing? All right, it's going to stain it. You're going to get some of the juice on the clothing. Well, here the picture is Christ is going forward throughout the world. During the Christian dispensation, he's involved in this spiritual war. And do you think Jesus has some enemies?
Yes.
Yeah. And in this life, do you think some of those enemies are going to get crushed? Stepped on? And that's the image. As Christ is out there, as he is the leader, as he is the one who is at the head of his people, he says, hey, you need to be on board with me, but I'm going to be the one out there leading the charge. And here's how fully I'm immersed in the battle. You know, some people are going to get squashed along the way. And the image is that blood, is ending up on his garment. As we look at time, though, we find that people have often thought that they could somehow, you know, overcome the Lord, or they could overcome his word. But the Bible says that can't be true. Heaven and earth shall pass away, but my word is not going to pass away. It never shall be. Matthew 24, verse 35. And then a passage we use less often, Psalm 119, verse 89. Thy word is settled somewhere. Anybody remember where it's settled? That word is settled in? Well, you do have that sentiment expressed sometimes, but in Psalm 189, it's settled in heaven. And if God's word has been settled in heaven, you think you're going to be able to change it? I mean, it's there. It's going to continue just as Jesus promised in Matthew 24, verse 35. The commentator I mentioned earlier made this point as well, which I think is a good quote. He said, those who oppose strong teaching of the laws of God and strong punishment for those who do not believe and obey them shout scare doctrines and legalism to slander the word of God and those who believe and teach it. Shame on you. If obedience to all of God's laws is legalism and fire and brimstone doctrine, then Jesus and the apostles were guilty, as we see from like Matthew 7, 2 John 9, and so forth. Anything that went at or asked before I make one other quick point? All right. As you look at verse 16, and this is one of the verses in the book of Revelation that you need to remember as you interact with some people today. And he hath on his garment and on his thigh a name written, what is it? King of kings, and he's Lord of lords. When most people read that passage, common sense would tell them that this is something that applies to him now, or this is something that applies to him in the future. King of kings, Lord of lords. He is, or he will be. All right, I think most people, if they're going to give an honest reading of the text, they would say he is now. Well, that's important because as we look at our society, what do a lot of people believe when it comes to Jesus having a kingdom and reigning as a king? He's reigning now, or he's going to reign in the future? All right. Well, here, Revelation 19:16, I've actually used this with people, and they really don't have a good answer for it. The best answer that I've heard from folks, and this doesn't make sense, well, he's ruling now, and he's kind of get a new and second and bigger rule in the future. Is that really what you believe? I mean, especially when you can open the Bible, and you've got capital letters in most translations. King of Kings, Lord of Lords. Well, does it seem like it's going to get any bigger and better beyond that? I mean, that sounds like it's about as big and glorious as it comes. And this is also consistent with the point that we've made multiple times. 1 Corinthians 15, verses 23 and 24, Paul said Christ is going to return at the end of time. Do we remember what Paul says about the kingdom? He's going to give it up, he's going to surrender it, or he's going to set it up. He's going to give it up. He's going to surrender it. That's what the text says. But the world, as we hear them talk about the kingdom, they say he's going to do what? He's going to come and set it up. Well, that can't be right. There's a difference between set up and surrender. There's a difference between set up and give up. So 1 Corinthians 15, Revelation 19, verse 16 tell us that the Lord is reigning now. Acts 2 tells us about verses 23 to 36, he was raised up. And after the resurrection, he began to reign, spiritually on the throne of David. And he's going to continue that spiritual reign until the end of time. And that's why he's King of Kings. He's Lord of Lords. Lord seems to have here the sense of sovereign ruler. That is, you know, whatever exists, Jesus is over that. And certainly when we look at kings, earthly rulers, earthly officials, Jesus is over them all. Bonnie?
The conversations I've had with my mother, she believes that. She gets that from the Lord's Prayer.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
that's how she interprets.
Yes. But if we go back and we look at, and I know that you know this, but for the sake of chronology, that prayer was given prior to Jesus going to the cross, dying, and being raised up. So you have there, after the resurrection, Acts 2, he's raised up, he receives the kingdom, Revelation 19, he's King of Kings and Lord of Lords now. And that's why in Matthew 28, 19 and 20, Jesus said, "All authority has been given unto me in heaven and on earth." And then with that authority, you need to go preach. But there are some people that would take that approach.
You know, that verse 16 where the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords is capitalized. I've been to a few concerts at Concord High School. And everyone I've been to, they sing that Alleluia chorus. And they always all stand up for that. They don't stand up for nothing else. But everybody stands up when they start singing that song.
Yeah. It's been puzzling to me over the years, and maybe one day I'll get this figured out. But when you deal with, and premillennialism is generally where you'll find this. They may not believe in all the tenets of premillennialism, but they'll believe in several. And on the one hand, they'll talk about King Jesus. Well, if you're going to be a king, don't you need something? Don't you need a kingdom? I mean, what are you king over? So they talk about King Jesus, and then, lo and behold, a couple of minutes later, they say, well, he's going to come and, you know, reign someday as a king. Reign on the earth. Well, what's he reigning over now if he's king? I mean, I've talked to people, they just look like, well, what planet did you get off of? You know, why would you ask that kind of question?
You don't call him the king in waiting.
Yeah. Like I say, I'm just almost without words when I have those kinds of conversations with people. And they seem a little flustered too, because I think in most cases it's kind of obvious that their belief doesn't logically line up with some of their other convictions. But anyway, so that's something that you can keep in mind as you deal with folks, and maybe it'll be helpful. Anything you want to add or ask?
A lot of people don't know anything about the Bible. They just have
their opinion.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I think Sherman's questions, as far as Christmas, have illustrated that pretty well. You know, they've heard about, you know, the three wise men and, you know, everybody was riding on the donkey and those kinds of things. But, you know, when you go back and you actually start looking at the text, what people have heard is not only sometimes inconsistent with what we find in the scriptures, oftentimes is completely inconsistent with what we find. But people have received information from mom or dad, or they've heard it on TV, or they've seen the video, and that's where they get their understanding of the Bible from. And that creates a lot of misunderstandings and wrong conclusions. That it? Okay. Let's pick up then with verses 17 and 18. "And I saw an angel standing in the sun, and he cried with a loud voice, saying to all the birds that fly in mid-heaven, 'Come and be gathered together under the great supper of God, that ye may eat the flesh of kings, and the flesh of captains, and the flesh of the mighty men, and the flesh of horses, and of them that sit thereon, and the flesh of all men, both free, bond, small, and great. Now, going backtracking just a couple of minutes, I said that in this chapter, and this is especially true for verses 6 through 16, we have a lot of information that relates to things that take place during the Christian era. But I've also said, John, we'll go through that information. We saw this with the seals, we saw this with the trumpets, we saw this with the plagues. Going back to the seven seals, he gives you the first six seals, things related to the Christian era. Then when he gets to that seventh seal, he talks about things related to events after Jesus' next and final coming. And then he says, all right, let's start the cycle again. So he turns to the seven trumpets, and he gives us the first six trumpets. Those refer to things that take place during the Christian era. Seventh trumpet refers to things after Jesus returns. Then he goes into the seven plagues, and it's the same cycle. First six deal with things related to the Christian dispensation. The seventh talks about things after the Lord returns. And then he just continues to go through the cycle time after time after time. Well, now John is coming to a point where he's kind of reached the end of the cycle, if you will, as far as the Christian dispensation. And now he's talking about some things that will take place in eternity. Now, what's the image that he sets up for us? What creature do we read about? There is an... All right, there's an angel. And where's this angel positioned? All right, now can you imagine, you know, for me, if you think about something in the sun, you would think, well, it's got to be pretty small. I mean, the sun's pretty big. But when you think about an angel standing in the sun, I kind of get the impression from that that this is a pretty big creature, you know, fairly significant. And what's this angel doing in the sun? I mean, just that part of the image is powerful, an angel standing in the sun. But what's the angel doing? Crying out. And crying out with what? A loud voice. Now, if you could put an angel, and again, this is another reminder that we're dealing with figurative language in this book. If you can put an angel in the sun, what does that say? Where would you rate that on a scale of 1 to 10 when it comes to getting people's attention? That's a 10, isn't it? I mean, that's, you know, sun's very visible to people, and it's a way of saying this is something you really need to pay attention to. And you also have crying, he's talking. And we said he's communicating with what kind of voice? A loud voice. So as far as what it is, where it's positioned, and the voice, it's really a way of saying this message needs to go how far? Everywhere. This is a really, really important thing to hear. Now, we would hope that for this kind of message, it would be good news, right? But it's not going to be good news. And we kind of already got the hint of that as far as what was read. Sherman?
I think with the sun also shows the brightness.
Yeah, it's kind of, you know, all hands are on deck to make sure that this information is communicated to folks, and pay close attention. If you've got a cross-reference, and you may have already looked at this, John, as we've said numerous times before, often goes back to the Old Testament for various images, various stories, and then uses that same imagery, but oftentimes uses it in a different way. And here, if you were to go back to Ezekiel 39, verses 17 through 19, you'd see some imagery there which sounds a lot like what we have here. Okay, let's talk about what this message was. And as I mentioned before, it's information that is not good news. It's also information that we see elsewhere in the New Testament. Do you remember back in Matthew chapter 25? There, Jesus talks about the Son of Man coming in His glory, and there's going to be a great separation of people. The righteous are going to be on one side of Him, the unrighteous are going to be on the other. And the Lord says, as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. So, we know that the Lord is going to come back. We know that there's going to be a separation, and with that separation, some are going to be classified as saved, and others are going to be classified as lost. Well, this is exactly what we see in Revelation chapter 19. Earlier in the book, and I mentioned this at the beginning of the class, back there in verse 9, he says, right, blessed are they that are bidden to what? To the marriage supper of the Lamb. There are going to be some people who are saved, and that's a reference to these folks. And they're in verse 9, specifically as they live the Christian life here. But now as we come down to verses 17 and 18, John, talking about things that will take place after the Lord returns, is referring to the unrighteous. Now, if we just stopped with the end of verse 17, come and be gathered together to the great supper of God. If that's as far as we went, does that sound positive or negative?
Positive.
I mean, it sounds really good, doesn't it? Hey, God's got a supper. Come on down. like Monty Hall way back when. But as you look ahead to verse 18, you see that this supper is not good. And it's really another way of describing the goats in Matthew 25, to say that the unrighteous are going to be gathered and they're going to be separated from the righteous people. And here, as the Lord talks about these, folks to John, he says there in verse 18, bring these people together so that what can take place? All right, that birds, all the birds of the heaven can eat these people. Well, that's kind of a gross picture, but it is John's description, God's description of what's going to take place with the unsaved at the end of time. Now, once again, will we understand this literally? No, because we're in a book that deals with a lot of symbolism, and there are a couple of other reasons for that as well. When the Lord returns at the end of time, do we recall what's going to take place with the earth and everything that is contained therein? All right. 2 Peter 3, verses 10 and following, you go back up to about verse 8, he makes that point. Hebrews chapter 1, verses 11 and 12 says the earth is going to perish, it's going to be, you know, kind of folded up, it's going to be destroyed and so forth. So when all that happens, what's going to take place with the birds? And the bears? And the snakes? Well, they're all going to be burned up, right? I mean, if the heavens and earth disappear, everything that is in them will also disappear. So how many birds are we going to have left?
None.
There will not be any birds left. So when he says, call in the birds, well, not literally true. But it is a way of describing great destruction. It's also, as you begin to think about this image, an idea that seems to go back to, once again, an Old Testament story. Remember Joseph? He ended up down there in the dungeon. And there were a couple of guys that ended up with him down there as well. Remember who those guys were? Oh, come on. No, no. Joseph, Old Testament character, way back in the book of Genesis, chapter 40. They were servants in Pharaoh's court. All right, we've got the baker and we've got the... All right, we've got the butler. And these two guys had dreams. Nobody could interpret the dreams except Joseph. When you go back and you look at the butler's dream... Did he have a good dream or a bad dream? He was that cupbearer for Pharaoh. Was he going to be restored or not? Yes, he was the one who was going to be put back into his position. But when you remember the baker, remember him? He remembered that you got the image there of a basket on his head, and there's some bread in the basket. And who shows up?
Birds.
And what do they do? All right. Now, if we'd had that dream, we'd probably be puzzled and think, man, what does that mean? And if you go back and you look at Genesis 40, you find that the butler, he got that good interpretation and human nature. Now the baker comes along and it's his turn and he's probably thinking what? Well, and this is what the text really indicates. He got a good explanation, so probably going to be the same that's true for me. But Joseph had to say the news is not so good. What's going to happen with you? It's not going to be very long, just a few days and... All right, you're going to be, you know, you're going to be put to death. You're going to die, and you know, you're going to end up impaled on a pole. And it's not a very pleasant death that you're going to experience. And you know, then the birds are going to come and you know have access to the body. So it seems to me that this is an allusion back there to Genesis 40. And the God that we serve is an amazing God. And you know, still, I am just surprised at this. When you begin to go back and look at the Old Testament events, this one. And how it points forward all the way, in some respects, to what's going to take at the place at the end of time. How could God have done that? When you look, for example, at Noah and the ark, and you see how that pointed forward to things related to the church, baptism. You know, again, how can God do that? Where you've got this Old Testament event, and it, or a person, and it points forward. Moses, how he pointed forward to Christ and so forth. And we've done a little of this as far as some Sunday evening sermons. We'll continue to do it. As time passes, you know, if the Lord wills. But it's just amazing to me that God did this kind of thing. And yet it seems like this does foreshadow the evil, the destruction that's going to take place for the unsaved at the end of time. Anything that you want to add or ask about that before I say a little bit more? Sherman?
This might be a weird image, but I kind of see these birds flying around like buzzards when you're flying over a dead animal or something, just waiting to attack.
Yeah. And there is a sense in which you think about time, you know, that day has been appointed. It's going to come. And whatever that destruction involves, I mean, it's being held in check. And then at the right time, that will fall, that will, if you will, descend on the unsaved, and it's going to be a very, very difficult time. So the image is not pleasant, but it is a warning to those who are not in a right relationship with God that you need to fix things or you're going to face a fate which is very, very unpleasant. Anybody else? Well, let's talk about some of the other characters that we have here in verses 17 and 18. John, as he talks about the unsaved, he said they may have been who? They're going to eat the flesh of kings. In ancient times, if you were going to have a military battle, you know, you're going to have somebody out there leading it. Who often would have led the military battle? The king. You know, David didn't always go, but there were times, remember with Bathsheba, you've got an exception there, but kings oftentimes would be, you know, they're going to be out there in front. They're going to lead their folks. So here we would think about officials, we would think about leaders, high-ranking folks, and then we come to captains. They would have been the commanders of troops, mighty men. Breaking it down a little more, they would have been the skilled warriors. Then you might also have some soldiers, the bondmen, the slaves, the non-slaves, the free, the small and great of the earth. Now, John, bear in mind the context. He's talking about saved people or he's talking about unsaved people? All right, the unsaved. Birds are going to come and eat their flesh. Now, the people that I just went through, you've got the high-ranking officials, you've kind of got medium-ranking officials, the captains and so forth, and you've got people who are very possibly poor, the slaves, and you've got some average folks, you've got the free, and so forth, a wide range of people. Well, isn't that what we will find when it comes to the unsaved at the end of time? Will there not be a wide range of folks? Yes. I think sometimes when people have power, when they have a lot of wealth, their thinking is, well, I may be in a situation where I get into some trouble, but what's going to happen? Because of who I am, because of what I have, what's going to be true for me? You might suffer, but I know somebody. Look at what I have as far as resources, and Betty got it right. I am not going to be in the same category as you. Well, that may be true in this life. But when it comes time to face God at the end of time, the rank, the status, the money, the power that we had, all these things in life will not matter. Well, isn't basically this the same message that we find elsewhere in the New Testament? We're all going to be manifest before the judgment seat of Christ, 2 Corinthians 5:10, that we can receive the things done in the body. It's not going to count as far as what we had and who we were. The only thing that's going to matter at the end of time is if we were in a right relationship with God. And if that's not going to scare some folks, it should. Let's go back for just a second to Revelation chapter 6. Earlier we have this same idea. Now, this is the sixth seal. And again, the seventh takes us into eternity, but the sixth brings us, in this case, right up to the end of time. You know, now it's ready for the Lord to come, and he basically shows up in Revelation 6, verses 12 through 17. And when he opened the sixth seal, when there was a great earthquake, and the sun became black as sackcloth of hair, the whole moon became as blood, and the stars of heaven fell to the earth, as a fig tree casts her unripe figs when she's shaken of a great wind. And the heaven was removed, and a scroll when it was rolled up, every mountain and island were moved out of their places. And here we start in verse 15. The kings of the earth, the princes, the chief captains, the rich, the strong, every bondman and freeman did what? Wanted to hide themselves in the caves. They asked for the rocks and the mountains to cover them. 15 as well as verse 16. They say to the mountains and to the rocks, fall on us and hide us from the face of him that sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of the wrath has come, and who is able to stand? Well, the answer to that question is nobody. But for the rich, for the middle class, if you will, for the poor, for those who are well-connected, for those who are not, John says, even as early as Revelation chapter 6, if you're not in a right relationship with God, it's going to be a very, very bad thing. Then let me pick up with a little more information, and we'll see if there's something that you want to add or ask. Back here in Revelation 19, verse 18, we also have some information about horses. He says that ye may eat the flesh of the kings, the flesh of the captains, and so forth. And then in about the middle of the verse, he says, and the flesh of the bones, or the flesh of the horses, and of them that sit thereon, and the flesh of all men, both free and bond, small and great. Now when you look at this expression, the flesh of horses and them that sit thereon. We've seen horses earlier in the book of Revelation, haven't we? Remember, we've got the pale horse. We've got the red horse, those various horses. And we said as we went through that information that they seem to stand for difficult things that God's people must face throughout the Christian era. For example, the red horse seems to be an image for persecution. And here the idea is that there were people on horses, not literally, but the horses back there, early in Revelation chapter 6, verses 4 through 8, the people who cause problems for God's people, what's going to happen to them at the end of time? The unsaved. Persecuting God's people, denying God's people a job, you know, taking the house because they were committed to Christ. Here John says, what's going to happen to those folks? They're going to get off scot-free? They're going to get their due. You know, a time is going to come where they're going to reap what they've sown. And that harvest is going to be a bumper crop. So here, as we think about the end of time, God assures his people, the persecutors, the other people who injured you in various ways, if they did not repent before they left this life, they are going to pay a heavy, heavy price. And it is going to be an eternal price. When John says he's going to destroy the flesh of the horses, this is referring to God. If you have a horse that you're depending on, you're depending on that horse for transportation, you're depending on that horse for safety and so forth, and you destroy the horse, well, what have you lost? You've lost your power, haven't you? You've lost the tool that you're using for transportation. You've lost the tool that you're using for battle. So here again seems to be an additional point. At the end of time, that flesh, if you will, figuratively speaking, is going to be destroyed. What does that suggest as far as the power of the unsaved throughout eternity? They're going to lose it. It's going to be taken away. The unsaved will lose every single thing that they possess except that eternal spirit. So when we look at life now, we find that death will separate God's people from various issues that now plague them, but certainly in eternity. There's going to be that fold. There's going to be that eternal separation where people are completely out of Satan's reach. They're completely out of reach for the people who were not favorable towards them in this life. And as you look at this, I would understand this as really another reference to Armageddon back in Revelation 16:16. That ultimate battle will take place at the end of time. It's going to once again be in the category of separating the righteous from the unrighteous, and things at that point will be, the accounts will be permanently settled, if you will. I'm going to give you this other quote and then see if there's something that you want to add or ask. One source said, he noted how the prospect of remaining unburied after death, so that birds and animals could feast on human remains, prompted among the ancients fear, as well as the possibility of taunting or cursing. There are a lot of Old Testament passages that you could go back and see that reflected in. But today, if a body's not buried to us, that's not a very pleasant image, but especially for the ancient people. I mean, they actually feared that. So John, using that image here, it would have been one more way of saying, whatever you would associate with hell, it's going to be that bad, and surely a whole lot worse. So you do not want to be on the wrong side. You don't want to be on the side of the beast, as he's going to continue with as we deal with the latter part of the chapter in a couple weeks. Anything that you want to add or ask over what we've said today? Okay. The